We all know that Freud was the father of psychoanalysis, but did you know he was a cocaine abuser? This hour, Howard Markel joins us to talk about Freud and other surprises in his book, The Anatomy of Addiction, like how the renowned surgeon William Halstead investigated the anesthetic properties of cocaine by experimenting on himself. Plus, the dog days of summer are here, time to pack the family into the station wagon, or maybe the Prius, and hit the road. But where to? Are geological formations like Mammoth Cave your thing? Or maybe something flashier, like the world's biggest laser? Let us know where you're going. It's your chance to play tour guide. Trip begins after this break. Stay with us. ¿Hablas español? Then check out our science news in Spanish at sciencefriday.com/Spanish. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Looking for something fun to do these dog days of summer, something different? Instead of a dip in your backyard pool, why not mosey on down to a local tidal pool and watch the crabs play? Or how about picking up a birding book or a botany guide and learning something about what's living right in your own backyard from the comfort of your hammock, of course. If you need an excuse to hit the road, you can get a one-of-a-kind geology lesson exploring the Grand Canyon, or the geysers and colorful pools of Yellowstone, or even underground lava tubes with the help of a flashlight. And if air conditioning is your prerequisite, and on a day like today it might be, there are hundreds of great science museums all across the country, mountaintop observatories, physics meccas like Lawrence Livermore Lab in Northern California, where you can see lots of geeky stuff, like the world's largest laser. So how are you spending the summer? Do you have some scientific itinerary of your own that you would like to share with us? Maybe you want to share a favorite spot from a past vacation. We'd like to hear from you. We want to hear your suggestions. Give us a call, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you'd rather tweet us, you can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI, or go to our website at sciencefriday.com and leave a suggestion there, or our Facebook page /SciFry. Here to help us along with some suggestions is my guest Keith Bellows, editor-in-chief of National Geographic Traveler, author of the forthcoming book, 100 Places That Will Change Your Child's Life. He joins us from our studios in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Nice to be here.
Because of the weather for this weekend, as we know it is, people want to stay indoors. Let's start with that. What museums would you recommend to visit?
Well, of course, it depends on the East Coast or the West Coast. My favorite museum in the country is the Exploratorium in San Francisco, which is really one of the great classic museums.
Yeah.
It was, you know, I took my, who's now 24, I took my son there when he was about five. We spent, 6 hours there. So, you know, any museum is good in this weather. Or you can go to Tuktoyaktuk, where you can see pingos in northern Canada. I mean, you don't always have to go inside if you want to find a little bit of science.
Yeah, and maybe going north, it might be a little cooler.
Indeed.
Crossing the border. Let's talk about outdoorsy stuff. People, I mentioned Mammoth Cave. Where is that? Tell us about what's so interesting about that.
That's Kentucky.
Yeah.
It is, believe it or not, the world's longest known cave. Obviously, we don't know where they all are, but it's about 400 miles of interconnected passages. They think there's actually about 1,000 miles down there, but they just don't know yet. So they're all, like, spending a lot of time. We see a lot of grant applications at the National Geographic about, can we get a little bit of money to find the next mile? But it's all down there.
And of course, there is the number one place on the list, which is the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, you know, I sort of call that the rock sandwich, because you can really see the entire world in front of you. I mean, if you think about it, if you can get to the place where you can see it from the side, every single layer is a piece of the world being laid down. So the entire world is there. And that's an amazing thing for kids or even adults to see, is that this idea that you can actually see in profile the world unfold.
How far down do you have to go?
Well, you have to go to, well, actually, most people do not go far enough because they spend their time on the lip, on the edge. But if you can get into, and one of the things that the National Park Service has, this North Rim 1 hour or half day mule ride that's designed specifically to get you down there so that you can actually see it in profile.
Wow. And of course, high on your list during the indoor part might be your aquariums. There are some great aquariums. I think one of my favorites is the Monterey Bay Aquarium.
Yeah, it's my favorite too. But you know, the really surprising one is the Georgia Aquarium. Hmm. You know, we all hear about the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and it's incredibly impressive. But the Georgia Aquarium is the world's largest aquarium. We're talking about there are more animals than, or more creatures than any other aquarium. We're talking. And they're all in 10 million gallons of water. So it's you know, it's a bit of a surprise because we always assume the best aquarium is going to be right on the water.
Right. Nope. Right. Here in New York, we have our treasure, the Bronx Zoo, but there are other great zoos in the country to visit, too.
Well, oh, absolutely. Columbus Zoo, Jack Hanna, of course, we all know him as a sort of a TV personality. But the Columbus Zoo, 8,000 animals representing over 700 species. This is a really, it may be one of our leading zoos. I would put it up in the top five.
Can you actually learn anything scientifically in these places, or are they more just to watch the animals?
I think you can learn something scientifically anywhere you are. And that's, of course you can. And it's all about the questions you ask and how well prepared you are. So I'm a parent. I take my... I take Mackenzie, who's my daughter, and Chase, my son, and they're both under 8 years old. Yeah, they can learn. I mean, they ask questions. And if you listen to what they have to ask, and you're a little bit prepared, and that, of course, is the big trick for parents, you could really get them to dive into science sort of in action, if you will.
Mm. Well, we've asked our listeners to chime in on their recommendations. Let's go to Beth in Orange Beach, Alabama. Hi, Beth.
Hello.
Hey,
speaking
there.
Of diving, my husband and I are avid cave divers. Next week, we are headed to Fort White, Florida to go cave diving. We can see fossils that are embedded in the walls. We can see the troglodytes that live in the caves, like blind catfish and albino crawfish, and some amazing geologic formations.
Wow.
72 degrees.
As an old scuba diver, I've got to give you credit for going underwater in a cave. I would not get within 100 yards of cave. It's very dangerous, too, but as long as you do it safely, it's a good place to try, you're saying.
Yes, it's a great way to get out of the heat. As soon as you get down on the Suwannee River or on the Santa Fe River, you're out of the sunshine. You're in all those overhanging oaks with all the Spanish moss. The water temperature is always 72, so it drops down from, 90 degrees down into the upper 70s, lower 80s, just in air temperature right around the water.
Wow.
And then you're just freezing by the time you get out, so it's fantastic for beating the heat.
This summer. Thanks a lot, Beth, for suggesting that.
All right. Thank you.
Have a good cave dive. 1-800-998-2255. Keith, a lot of people do cave diving.
They do, and I'm terrified of it. Honestly, it's like I get the idea. I think it's an incredible thing, but it's I'm a bit claustrophobic, so I prefer to stay a little bit above ground.
Right.
But for those of you who can do it, go for it.
What about I mentioned some of the big national laboratories? Will they actually let us in and look around there?
Yeah, they really will. Well, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory is probably the granddaddy of it. This laboratory is basically charged with ensuring the nation's security through scientific research and engineering and such like that. But you can get in there. They have a discovery center. It gives you a little bit of a glimpse of what the state-of-the-art research is going on. There are tours. They're not, you can't just turn up and go every day. But there's tours for adults on Tuesdays. But yes, and MIT Lab has some access, not a lot, but these are the places where science is being made.
I have here's a tweet that came in from Tony Perry, who says, go to Maker Faire. Oh, they're all around the country. There's one happening in Detroit the end of July weekend. Real people putting science into action during the fair. Nothing more exciting or inspiring. We have been to Maker Faire, and that's a really interesting place to visit, one of the Maker Faires.
That's very cool.
Going on around the country. Of course, there are people who are saying, no trips. I'm staying in to finish my dissertation.
I saw that. I thought that was great. And you know what? Hello. There's some real truth to that. No trips. You don't necessarily have to travel to experience science. I mean, one of the really things, the things that I treasure about my kids is I can get them in the backyard. I watch them as their nose gets closer and closer and closer to the ground. And boom, they found a bug. They found something that excites them. They found something that we can talk about. Mm-hmm. They found something that we can actually go to the internet and figure out what is this red bug with the black thing on its head.
Same is true of the bird feeder.
Oh, absolutely. The bird feeder, for sure. In fact, right now we have a nest on our front porch, and all we see are those little tiny, you know, beaks opened up. And, of course, the parents are cruising around the house absolutely outraged that we should get so close to their children.
I'll bet. Let's go to Jerry in Columbus. Hi, Jerry.
Good afternoon. Ira, I like to listen to you every Friday. Great program.
Thank
and this
you.
Is most interesting because if I was able to, I would go back where my son and I went backpacking 74, 75, and 76 at Isle Royale National Park. I hope you know where I'm talking geographically.
Lake Superior.
It's an about
Lake
15
Superior, yep.
miles off Thunder Bay, Ontario. Belongs actually part of Keweenaw County, Michigan, but it's been a national park for 71 years. And fantastic, pristine area. Got a lot of wolves. I don't know how many there are today. When we were there, there were 43 wolves estimated and about 1,300 moose. We saw plenty of moose, but not a lot of wolves. Great fishing, 36 inland lakes on this island.
Do you work for the Chamber of Commerce on this one? That sounds great.
No, sir. I just find it's the only place in the Midwest, Ira, where you can go backpacking and the crowds aren't there.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot I don't know what their annual visitation is, but the interesting thing is that now there was an article in the Sunday paper last week from about the warming up there. They even are encountering deer ticks on Isle Royale, which normally don't thrive where the winter temperature doesn't average 19 degrees or above. And the Lake Superior water temperature is rising. Just an interesting place. I wish you'd do a whole program on it, Ira, because all kinds of... There's even on Raspberry Island, a small island off Isle Royale, there is a Venus flytrap plant I just observed yesterday when I was reviewing some of my color slides. Remember those?
Jerry, Jerry, I only have an hour.
Okay.
So I'm going to have to...
appreciate the time, Ira, and you have a wonderful day.
Thanks a lot. Have a good vacation out there. We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more with Keith Bellows. Maybe you have your own vacation spot, scientific, nature, whatever you'd like to suggest. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Also, tweet us at SciFry, and you can go to our Facebook page /SciFry. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. No need to be locked down to your laptop. You can take Science Friday with you. Find our apps in the iTunes Store and the Android Marketplace so you can really take this show and shove it right into your pocket. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're trying to find some really interesting out-of-the-way places that you can go to, maybe drive or take a train nearby places, scientifically oriented. Tweets are coming in. I have one from... Zork Fox, who says, I've been to the VLA. That's the very large array. I highly recommend it. It is so awesome. Is that on your list, Keith?
It would be. I'd love to see the Great Array. I mean, the fascination of being looking at the sky all the time. Of course, I'm not sure how interested he is watching the sky. But,
it's like watching paint dry.
Yeah, exactly. A little bit, but pretty cool.
Pretty cool. What else would be on your list?
I have so many places on my list. And, of course, I'm supposed to stay. Do I have to stay in the United States? Because one of the places that I think is the sort of the engine of the world is Antarctica. And if I could go anywhere, that would be where it is. I mean, you're seeing weather change. You're watching the dynamics of the world right there. And it's right in front of your eyes. I talked to somebody yesterday who told me that driving into, and of course you're driving in a sailboat, into these incredible ice fields is like the top 5% of the Alps. And if you imagine everything is water up to the top 5% of the Alps, and you're just driving into these top peaks, and there you see truly something that no one else gets to see.
I was there 32 years ago.
Oh, my goodness.
And it changed my life forever, just because of the absolute beauty of it. And
yeah. Actually, well, this guy was completely transformed.
Yeah, you are, and you never look at the world the same way again. To see a 14,000-foot peak of a mountain and only a little tiny bit of it sticking out at the top.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And I fell off a glacier, but that's another story. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Katie in Denver. Hi, Katie.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to recommend that if you're in Colorado or in the West, that you could take a mine tour, because there's actually a lot of really cool geological things to see, and kids really enjoy it because they can, like, go gold panning and things like that. So,
find a mine. Take a tour. Hopefully one that's not working at the moment, right?
I'm sorry?
Yeah,
the Phoenix Gold Mine is one in Idaho Springs.
Yeah. All right. Thanks.
It's only about an hour outside of Denver. So.
Thanks for that suggestion, Katie. Of course, if you go to Alaska, you can go to those panning for gold tourist thingies. Also, couldn't you, Keith?
You can, but let's just stay away from the touristy stuff, right?
Right. Have you been into these mines? Would you suggest those places?
I haven't, but I've been into the mining areas, but I haven't been into the mines because it's like going, you know, it's going back down into those, you know, cave diving, and I'm just not going to go there.
Yeah, I understand. It's claustrophobic. You know, one of the things as a parent, I knew that I didn't want my trip. You take your kids along, and it's sort of wasted on them, right? They don't know how to appreciate what they're seeing. Is there any way you can prep your kid, you know, for that trip, or is it smart just to let them discover on their own?
Well, I think there's three things. First of all, there's an illusion that the kids are too young. Kids have muscle memory. I started traveling when I was about 3. I was born in Africa. And I think that once you get that feeling of travel, the rhythm of it, the idea that something's foreign or different, that's a very important thing to inculcate in a child. So the idea that they're too young is really more a convenience for the parent to say, you know, it's a hassle to bring my 5-year-old along. The second thing is yes, you can prep. And the thing is to try to come up, do the research so that you have 3 or 4 stories and 4 or 5 questions. So the stories are to get the kids excited about the place they're going. The questions are to get them to start to think about asking questions. And then the third thing is to be willing to let them go where they want to go and not try to control the experience.
Mm-hmm. Good suggestions. 1-800-989-8255. Mike in Morris Plains, New Jersey. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi there.
My suggestion is it's a common summer activity. You go to the beach, and we fly kites with my kids. You can play around with the bridle of the kite. You can learn a little bit about aerodynamics. You can look at the clouds. And then if you're living in our area, the New York metro area, and really want to tie it into science, go to Liberty State Park, where there's a constant wind blowing, and there's the Liberty Science Center, a really great science museum right there. You can, you know, use the open field where people do go to fly kites because of the constant wind, and then duck into the museum for a little bit of pool and other science stuff.
Do you ever take your kids into, searching for the tidal pools around the jetties and things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I've probably spent more time trying to keep the kids from falling into the tidal pool. You know, New Jersey has jetties. They're really fun to walk on, and you can look at a lot of crabs and barnacles and things like that. But I guess I'm more of an engineer, techie kind of guy, and less of a biology kind of guy. So that was more to do a little rock scrambling.
Yeah, good suggestions, Mike. Stay cool.
Thanks.
Have a good weekend. There is a lot to do at the beach, Keith, isn't there?
Well, there is. And what I loved about what he said was, you're talking about one of the best science museums in the country, the Liberty Science Museum. And yet, his child got as much out of what happens outside the museum as what happens inside the museum. And this idea of being able to allow children to see the world not as a contained sort of museum experience, but as something that is just there, is really important. So the aerodynamics, for instance, of a kite, fantastic.
You know, the latest studies show that most people learn their science in informal science education places outside of classrooms.
Exactly.
And this would be a museum, us, whatever. This would be the case where these things happen.
Well, then we all know about nature deficit disorder.
Right.
I mean, this idea that nature deficit disorder.
Yeah.
Yes, this is a big deal. The idea that our children are not being, you know, introduced to nature and allowed to experience it in the way that they used to be. And that's where they get their learning, because that's their natural curiosity being focused where they want to focus it.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, you could just sit in your hammock if you had a good nature book, right? And if you had a bird book, like one of our tweets came in from Warm Charity. He says, I just got the Audubon Society bird app. Oh, for your phone. And have cataloged my entire backyard's aviary.
Very cool.
How cool is that?
That's very cool.
And there are also apps out now. I remember seeing one. We tried one out that will identify the bark on trees. Or just, you know, you take a picture of the tree and look at the bark, and I'll tell you what tree it is.
And not to do a plug for the GO, but I will do it. We have something called NOAA, which allows you to see something, post it, and get somebody to tell you what it is.
Wow. That is cool. Let's go to Neil in Grand Rapids. Hi, Neil.
Hi. How are you?
Hi there. Go ahead.
Two recommendations, in indoor and outdoor. The Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore in Munising, Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula, and the Ford Rouge Tour in Detroit.
Oh, the car plant.
Yeah. They've got a bio roof on there, and you get to see the production line, and if you go during working hours, you get to see people working.
That's great to see people working.
Especially if you're on vacation.
Yeah. All right, good suggestions. Have a great summer.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Any last suggestions, Keith?
Oh, gosh.
I know you got a whole list of them. It's hard. It's like parents, you know, who are your favorite kids? What are your favorite places?
Well, you know, one of the great places, I mean, it's sort of maligned a little bit. And I remember in 1968 when they turned it off. It was Niagara Falls. And I actually got a chance to walk across Niagara Falls.
I thought I saw you there. I was there also.
Yeah. Okay, there we are. but what's so great about that is that if you look at that phenomenon right between America and Canada, and just it's probably, it, I think, and I don't have the exact science here, but I think it has more water goes over that per second than any other falls, including Iguazu and Victoria Falls. But the power of that and the power to get a kid excited or even an adult excited is amazing. And it's right there.
Right.
And right next to Ripley's, believe it or not.
And it's interesting how far that the falls have traveled backwards. The whole length of that gorge, it gets eaten away and moves backwards, right?
Exactly.
It has a hard rock on top and soft on the bottom, and when it comes down there, it eats up the bottom. And that's why they dried it up in 68 to try to figure out if they should do something about it.
And they found all that trash.
Yeah, they found exactly. At NPR in 1972, we tried to throw a barrel over Niagara Falls and they drained so much water out of it during the winter because the tourists are not there to make electricity that they had these pools on the side that.
Wasn't that amazing, though, when they turned it off? I mean, that was something.
It is. If you want to know what we're talking about, you can Google Niagara Falls and see it dried up and people walking on it. And it was scary, but it was a lot of fun. And you were a lot of fun. Keith, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure, Ira. Have a great weekend.
You too. Stay cool. Keith Bellows is editor-in-chief of National Geographic Traveler, author of the forthcoming book, 100 Places That Will Change Your Child's Life. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. You might think of cocaine as a party drug from the 70s and 80s, but 100 years before that, in the 1880s, a guy by the name of Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, was suiting up in white tie and gloves, attending soirees in Paris, and snorting a little cocaine to, quote, untie his tongue. Around the same time, Pope Leo XIII gave a special Vatican gold medal to the maker of Vin Mariani, a concoction of Bordeaux wine and cocaine. Pope Leo was said to carry around a flask of the stuff himself. And across the channel, a young surgeon named William Halsted, who pioneered many techniques still used in surgery today, for example, he invented the surgical glove, was investigating the white powder and its anesthetic properties, a potential wonder drug for the surgical profession. And many times, his experiments involved injecting it into himself. Cocaine right through the vein, to the point where he became totally hooked, leaving screaming patients in the operating room behind and descending into a month-long cocaine binge. These are just few of the stories in the new book, An Anatomy of Addiction, Sigmund Freud, William Halsted, and the Miracle Drug Cocaine, a fascinating read about two scientists who abused cocaine and why they were so intrigued by it in the first place. And it was written by our monthly science fiction contributor, Howard Markel, professor of history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. Welcome back, Howard.
It's great to be here. Good afternoon, Ira.
This is really a fascinating book. What made you decide to take this project on?
Well, I became very interested in seeing addicted patients in my own clinic, and I tend to understand the world as completely as I can as both a historian and a physician, and I wanted to learn a little bit more about the origins of addiction. And as I studied more and more and read more and more, I came across both Sigmund Freud and William Halsted, and I became addicted to their life stories. They were so fascinating. They were so compelling. And I thought, using their lives and their struggles, I could really put a human face on this terrible disease.
Tell us about what there was at that turn of the century, over 100 years ago, that period of time where cocaine seemed to be popping up everywhere. Sigmund Freud, you had it in these doctors, and you had it in Arthur Conan Doyle talking about Sherlock Holmes. The world seemed to, and we hear stories that Coca-Cola was invented around that time.
Absolutely. In the 1880s, even though coca leaves had been chewed by the aboriginals in South America for millennia, around the early 1800s, as European explorers started traveling to South America, they brought some coca leaves back. And they were very impressed by the endurance and the stimulation that came from chewing coca leaves. But over the next several decades in the 1800s, chemists and scientists began to search for that active ingredient. Mm-hmm. What was it that made chewing coca leaves so buzzy and exciting? And indeed, they did find out how to crystallize an alkaloid salt called cocaine hydrochloride. And the drug companies, the pharmaceutical houses of the era, loved it. It was their blockbuster drug. And they sold it as a cure for upset stomach, for flatulence, for consumption, for depression, for morphine addiction. Well, perhaps they oversold it a bit, but it was truly the miracle drug of its era.
Mm-hmm. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Howard Markel, who's author of an incredible new book, An Anatomy of Addiction. And how did Freud discover it and get hooked on it?
Well, Freud, and it was really fun to get to learn about Freud as a young, nervous man who was eager to make his career. We always think of Freud as this icon with that beard and that grim countenance. But he was a nervous fellow and wanted to make good. And he was looking for something that would make his name. And he practiced medicine in Vienna, which was probably the most competitive medical marketplace in the world at that time. The Vienna General Hospital was the place to train. And he knew if he was going to get a professorship, he would have to discover something great. So he read various little case reports in the journals about how great cocaine was for fighting off depression or fatigue. And he found an interesting little report that it could help you if you had morphine addiction. And morphine and opium were terrifically overprescribed back then. And what the medical profession did was create a lot of addicts. And one of Sigmund's best friends, a man named Fleischl Marxo, was a great physiologist who injured his hand. He had to have his thumb amputated. And he had terrible chronic pain. And he became a hopeless morphine addict. So Sigmund wanted to help his friend. He also knew that if he could write this up, he could really become famous. And so he studied this. He began studying it in 1884, read the whole world's literature on the topic, and wrote a very prominent monograph called Über Coca, or On Coca, that really excited the entire medical world about all of its medical and therapeutic uses except for one. He missed the major use of cocaine as a medical agent. It is a terrific local anesthetic.
Huh. And a few months after Freud got his first shipment of cocaine in 1884, he wrote a letter to his fiancée describing how it feels. Can you read a little bit of that for us?
I thought you'd never ask. Yes, on June 2nd, 1884, it's about a month or two after he started dabbling with cocaine, he writes to Martha Bernays, his fiancée, "Woe to you, my princess. When I come, I will kiss you quite red and feed you till you are plump. And if you are forward, you should see who is the stronger, a gentle little girl who doesn't eat enough or a big wild man who has cocaine in his body. In my last severe depression, I took coca again, and a small dose lifted me to the heights in a wonderful fashion. I am just now busy collecting the literature for a song of praise to this magical substance."
Pretty racy stuff for that, though.
Pretty racy indeed. And the great thing about Freud is that he's an inveterate letter writer. And you can really track his entire life through his letters to his fiance, to his friends, to another friend named Wilhelm Fleiss. And he does get rather specific about how magical and exciting cocaine is for him.
All right. Let me take a break. We're talking with Howard Markel, author of An Anatomy of Addiction, Sigmund Freud, William Halstead, and the Miracle Drug Cocaine. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. Also, you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com, leave a message there, or go to our Facebook page /SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be back. Take your questions. Talk more about An Anatomy of Addiction. Stay with us. 1-800-989-8255. Got a hankering for a bit more conversation? You didn't like what you heard. You want to hear more of it? Well, you can keep the chat going at Science Friday's Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/SciFry. Or you can tweet us all week long at SciFry. That's at SCIFRI. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with author Howard Markel about An Anatomy of Addiction. 1-800-989-8255. Before we move on to another protagonist in the book, the other Halstead, the other major figure, let me ask you one question I'm sure that comes up all the time and you address, is what did cocaine have to do with Freud and his theories? Did it have any influence and anything like that?
Well, it's a complicated answer. It's yes and no. I mean, there are points in Freud's early cocaine abuse where he was amazed at how loquacious it made him, how it freed up ideas that he thought were locked within his mind. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
And, of course, that's what a safer version of that is, free association, where you're simply talking about things and going from topic to topic to try to delve what's in your unconscious or subconscious mind. But I think he quickly learned, both with his friend Fleischl Marxo, who became not only a morphine addict but also a cocaine addict, and also with another patient he nearly killed while treating her with cocaine, that this was a rather toxic substance. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, his most important dream, the dream that became the model for the interpretation of dreams, was indeed a dream about cocaine use and the problems that resulted from treating this patient, Emma Eckstein, with cocaine.
Interesting. Finish up.
Well, he dreamed that he was at a party and the Emma character came to him, a crowded party, and there were syringes and cocaine and scabs all around, and she accused him in front of this gathering, "You nearly killed me. This is terrible." And Freud wondered about this and said, "Well, I had this dream because I'm such a concerned physician that if any of my patients have a bumpy course, I feel it as well." Well, in reality, Freud had this dream because he was rather upset and nervous that he nearly killed her while treating her, both himself under the influence and while she was taking cocaine. With a surgical mistake, a colleague of his operated on Emma's nose and left a surgical sponge in the site, and she nearly died. So talk about dreams as wish fulfillment. Here's a perfect example of that. So cocaine did have some impact on his thinking and on his life.
Yes, and it certainly had an impact on the other major protagonist in your book, the renowned surgeon William Halstead, who was a contemporary of Freud's. Tell us about what happened with him.
Well, Halstead, of course, Freud and Halstead probably never met, although they were both working at the Vienna General Hospital at the same time.
I found that hard to believe. As I'm reading your book and these parallel lives, knowing that, I'm saying, well, they never, bumped into the cafeteria or something like that?
Well, I've had fantasies many a night while writing this that they somehow passed each other. But my historian's ethics,
because
I have
at
no
each
document.
Other down the hall.
Yeah, rubbing each other's noses. But I could not find any documentation. Yeah. But they must have seen each other. It's not that big of a place. But Halstead, of course, read not only Freud's very famous paper on cocaine, but a subsequent paper that came out about a month later by a man named Carl Kohler that demonstrated that if you did a cataract operation and you took a dropper full of water and cocaine, you could anesthetize the eyeball. And so Halstead was fascinated that here is a safe local anesthetic that I could use on my operations, because back then they had ether and chloroform, but those were very toxic and obnoxious drugs. They made you throw up a lot. They really caused a lot of sleepiness and sedation. So he started experimenting with that, and he used, as many doctors did, his own arm. He was his own guinea pig, and he was injecting it and very rapidly went down the tubes as a cocaine addict.
To the detriment of his patients, you point out.
Yeah, most he stopped going to the hospital. He stopped going to meetings. He stopped writing. And most infamously, he was called down to see a patient at the Bellevue Hospital. It was a serious fracture, a leg fracture in a laborer who fell off the roof of a building. And Halstead was quite the expert at repairing these types of injuries. And you also have to remember that a broken leg of that magnitude, where the bone was literally sticking out of the skin, was almost always a fatal case if somebody did not intervene immediately. And Halstead was so bombed out of his mind on cocaine that he actually withdrew from the operating table and said, "I cannot operate," and then went home and skittered away the next several months high on cocaine.
Wow. And it eventually had that addiction his whole life.
Well, he did. Around that period, a good friend of his, William Henry Welch, who became one of the founders of the Johns Hopkins Hospital, promised he would bring Halstead with him and in this great medical experiment, but only if he got clean. And first, he tried to take Halstead on an ocean voyage. That didn't work very well. Halstead brought along his own supply of cocaine, and then he broke into the first aid kit when he ran out. And finally, Welch said, "You've got to take care of this. This is a huge problem." And Halstead admitted himself to an insane asylum, the Butler Hospital for the Insane in Rhode Island, and stayed there for many months to try and rid himself of this problem. Unfortunately, he gained another problem, because while they were trying to get him off cocaine, they gave him morphine. So he emerged as both a cocaine and a morphine addict for the rest of his life.
Wow. It's amazing the history, and you're a historian, about science, where people don't realize the impact of the stuff they're fooling around with. Yeah,
and back then nobody knew about addiction as we understand it, that certain drugs could be addictive, or that if you try to take somebody off of one addictive drug with another addictive drug, it was really a game of musical chairs. But they didn't realize that, and these guys were very heroic to, be the first guinea pig, and yet they really did major harm to themselves that they had to pay for dearly.
Let's go to Joel and at Columbia University here in New York. Hi, Joel.
Hi, I'm my name's Joel Whitebook, and I'm writing an intellectual biography of Freud for Cambridge University Press, actually. And there's a question that's come up, and I wonder whether Dr. Markell could help me with it. As I'm sure he knows, while Freud was experimenting with cocaine, he was also having all these heart problems. They call it the cardiac episode. And it seems so obvious that if it didn't cause the cardiac problems, that the cocaine must have been an enormous contributor to all the heart trouble he was having. I wonder what Dr. Markell thinks about the connection between the cocaine use and the cardiology pathology.
All right, thanks.
Well, my answer is great minds think alike, doctor. That's very true. And there are many letters where Freud is complaining of chest pain, of tachycardia, of all sorts of problems. And in fact, he sees one of his friends, Joseph Breuer, to examine him, and Breuer misses the diagnosis. And Freud thought it was just due to other things. He never quite made that connection, as many addicts will do. They don't want to stop using their their treasured substance. So they'll find any excuse under the sun that's causing these physical problems. But I agree with you. In my retrospective diagnosis, mm-hmm. there's no question that the severe cardiac symptoms Freud was having, as well as severe nasal symptoms. He was plugging up his nose. He was so congested, he had to have a special hot Bovie knife inserted into his nose to burn a hole in the congested tissues. He had a number of physical problems as a result of his cocaine abuse, yes.
Oh, I don't think we ever realized that. 1-800-989-8255. So when does cocaine, sort of the dangers of it, get to be recognized and now it's no longer available to anybody who wants to get it?
Well, that happened rather quickly after this big push that it was the miracle drug of all time. And that's one of the exciting things about writing about cocaine is that, you know, you don't have a long period of safe use with that drug. You go downhill pretty quickly if you're abusing it. And within several, you know, a few years, there was a whole cohort of people, and William Halstead was one of them, who are just wrecked men. Many of them were doctors, by the way, but they were wrecked human beings. They were paranoid. They were thin. They were jittery. They couldn't sit still. And they were true cocaine addicts. And the medical literature, beginning in the late 1880s and certainly by the 1890s, said, hey, this is not something we should prescribe willy-nilly. And in fact, by the early 20th century, the United States Congress passed a law controlling things, not just cocaine, but also narcotics such as morphine and opium and even marijuana, that you could not simply sell this stuff over the counter, that you had to have a doctor's prescription in order to obtain it.
Let's go to Bonnie in San Antonio. Hi, Bonnie. Bonnie, are you there? Bonnie, I guess.
My Bonnie lies over the ocean.
I wasn't going to touch that. I'm glad you did. I have enough pun trouble to begin with in my career. Yeah. So cocaine then gets normally accepted as what? Or is just put on a shelf? Do doctors turn the clock ahead? Do we now know about its medicinal benefits and how to use it correctly?
Well, there's all this generational forgetting, as you may recall, in the 1970s and the 1980s. It was advertised as the safe and elite and cool drug to do, but we quickly found out that was not the case. All you had to do was read the old stuff in the 1880s. But no, it became a very popular recreational drug, to be sure. Remember, well into the 1930s, remember the Cole Porter song, I Get No Kicks From Champagne? Well, the second verse is, I get no kicks from cocaine. One sniff bores me terrifically. And if you watch Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times in the 1930s, he's accidentally given some cocaine. It's one of the funniest scenes of all of Hollywood that was ever filmed. But it was also for many years and to some extent is still used as a local anesthetic by ear, nose, and throat surgeons. And then a safer form of what are called lidocaine and novocaine, which is a similar drug to cocaine, but it doesn't have that euphoric effect, has been used and is used all the time by dentists and people who need to do local anesthesia.
Mm-hmm. After he finally went clean, did Halstead make any more contributions to the surgical field? Was he finished at that point?
No, that's the wonderfully fascinating part of his story, is that Welch really helped him, brought him down to Baltimore. He was his minder. They lived together. They had dinner together, and he took him under his wing. He did not have a surgical position initially at Johns Hopkins. He was in the lab. He was operating on dogs. And he was working on some of his greatest procedures, how you operate on the abdomen, how you operate safely and delicately so that the wounds heal safely, inventing the rubber glove, interesting procedures on breast cancer and thyroid disease. Hmm. And his most active periods coincided with the times he could lay off the drug. And his most fallow periods, in fact, where he couldn't operate at all, where he'd walk out of the operating room or he'd go AWOL from the hospital entirely and no one knew where he was coincident with the time where he was abusing at the most point. Now, he probably went on binges of cocaine off and on every summer or so, but he used morphine, a dose of morphine, probably every night for the rest of his life.
Wow. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Plato, talking with Howard Markel, author of An Anatomy of Addiction. Cocaine, you know, I remember reading about it in Sherlock Holmes's his adventures. Was it Quick Watson the Needle, that sort of thing?
Quick Watson the Needle, yes. And Watson always said, why are you taking that drug? It's so dangerous.
did Sir Arthur Conan Doyle know these people, or was it just the times he was living in?
Well, Arthur Conan Doyle was not only a very astute physician, he was also a great medical journalist before he became the novelist that we recall today. And he really kept abreast of the medical literature, the latest scientific and medical discoveries. And so he undoubtedly read Sigmund Freud's Uber Coca. By the way, later on in life, Sigmund Freud was a great Sherlock Holmes fan.
Oh, no kidding.
No kidding at all. And so he read Uber Coca, and he likely read because he was interested in eye surgery, he definitely read Carl Kohler's paper about cocaine anesthesia and probably played with it a little bit himself. And, of course, he gave his character Sherlock Holmes, who was based on a doctor. Sherlock Holmes had the diagnostic deductive capability of a doctor, and he gave him as one of his characteristics a love of 7% solution, a 7% cocaine solution that he injected in his mottled arm.
Yeah. Howard, we usually have you on as our guest for science diction, with the origin of scientific words. And, of course, the theme in your book is where does the word addiction come from? You want to give us that?
Yes, and while you know, Freud and Halstead and the 1880s with cocaine and even morphine, that's the birth of the modern addict as we understand it, as a excessive use to the point of loss of control of a substance. It really it wasn't that term that it didn't mean that at all until the late 19th century. In fact, the word comes from a Latin word, addictio. And in antiquity, it was an edict of Roman law, so that if I owed you a great deal of money, Ira, and I couldn't pay you back, you would take me before a judge, and he would make me your addict, your slave, until I'd have to work for you until I could pay you off. And that was the nature of the term addiction or addict well into the 1500s. Later on, it became a term for describing someone's bad habits, if you ate too much, if you were too stubborn, if you smoked too much. But we don't see its use as the loss of control due to an exogenous substance that you take until the late 1880s or early 1890s.
And it would make sense because of the original definition, as you say, is you're basically enslaved to someone.
Yeah.
And so you're enslaved to this drug. I would imagine.
To this drug, yeah. And now as we're learning more and more about the science of addiction and what these substances and perhaps even behaviors such as hypersexuality or gambling or what have you, these stimulate the pleasure center of the brain, the limbic center of the brain, in such a way that it really changes the architecture, the wiring, to put it crudely, of the brain so that you lose the ability to say no.
Yeah.
And you know it's harming you, but you still do it.
And the problem is undoing the wiring. Then.
Exactly. Yeah.
So because, as you say, addiction is something that's physically changed in your brain.
Yeah. So that the first dose or two or 100 may be voluntary. But, once you change a cucumber into a pickle, you can't change that pickle back into a cucumber. So you have to come up with other means, very clever means of medical and psychological treatment to try to help people get off their drugs of choice.
Well, Howard, I'm not clever enough to top that analogy. So,
I think you are. I think you
are. That's a beauty. That's a great way to end the segment, Howard. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Ira.
Howard Markel is author of An Anatomy of Addiction, Sigmund Freud, William Halstead, and the Miracle Drug Cocaine, an absolutely fascinating read. You can take it with you to the beach this weekend. Some of you have asked us, why is it necessary to include ads in these podcasts? It's a good question. The simple answer is we have to find some way to pay for them. NPR does not underwrite our podcasts or any of our social media, like our website or our videos. In fact, they only contribute 10% of our total budget. So instead of charging you for this podcast, we put in a couple of ads. If you'd like to help close that deficit, please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the support button and donate a few bucks. Thanks.